Good to see so many people from East Side this morning. And now, a good number of you from other congregations have come to help us out. Thanks. What a joy it is to be with so many people. As I was talking to Jerry this morning, I just don't think there's any place where they sing better than they do here. I shouldn't say any place where you sing better. This is, it's when you're away and you're in small congregations, to hear 200 people joining their voices together to praise God, it sends chill bumps up and down your spine a bit. So don't take it for granted. I don't think you do. Thank God that you have so many people with whom you can praise God together. Sometimes when we're reading the Old Testament, we read things that make us scratch our head. Why did God command that? It seems almost bizarre. Some difficult text in the Old Testament. Modern atheists, you've probably heard the name Richard Dawkins, people like him, they like to get sarcastic about those texts, put the worst possible spin they can on them, and then use that to try to slam our faith. And I think these types of attacks are having their effect. I think some young people are using some of these accusations against the Bible, the Old Testament in particular, as justification for losing their faith and departing from it. So we're going to ask ourselves the question today, are all of God's commands in the Old Testament moral? Now this is, as you can imagine, a bit of a heavy-duty topic, and yet some people who are close to me are struggling with some of these things. And I have a feeling that others are. I don't think I've ever heard a lesson on this type of a topic. So I hope it'll be helpful to us, especially to some who may be struggling. Of course, in a short lesson like this, we only have time to briefly summarize some important points. If you want to look more deeply into it, I would recommend this book, Is God a Moral Monster? You can find it anywhere. But he takes on with a lot of detail, a lot of the texts that people use to try to twist and attack the Bible. We're going to divide this lesson into two parts. The first part is probably the most important part. I don't want you to leave after the first part. Stick around. The rest is important too. But we're going to talk about some important general principles when dealing with difficult Old Testament texts before we actually get into them themselves. And then we're going to analyze some of the toughest ones, especially in light of those principles that we've given. So, when we're talking about the tough text in the Bible, these are some of the accusations that are usually made. The Old Testament is against women. God promotes slavery in the Old Testament. We may mention the New Testament a little bit as well. And what about all those texts in the Old Testament where God commands violence? Can we harmonize those texts with the concept of a loving God? So that's a little bit of a preview of what we're going to be talking about. First of all, let's go to those essential, and I'm going to underline the fact, essential preliminaries as we take on those tough texts. First of all, we believe on the basis of what we can understand and accept the fact that we are not going to grasp everything. The best example in the Bible I have at this point is the blind man in John chapter 9. I have a feeling that most of you know that story pretty well. This is the chapter where Jesus met a man who was born blind, sent him to the pool of Siloam to wash. The blind man returned seeing. Well, that grabbed the attention of Jesus' religious enemy, the Pharisees. And they began to attack that blind man as if he had done something wrong by being healed. This man, Jesus, is a sinner. And we know so because he is healed on the Sabbath day. If you think about that a little bit, it makes no sense at all. The fact that he was healed should have overwhelmed everything else in their mind. But like a lot of modern critics, they didn't focus on the obvious. They were just trying to pick apart Jesus. He is a sinner. Well, what about that blind man in John chapter 9? Would he have had a deep understanding of the Old Testament law? He was blind. They did not have Braille, as far as I know, in ancient Hebrew. He would not have known the Old Testament. What about all the rabbinic laws about the Sabbath? He would have had no idea. Exactly who is this Jesus? Well, he had acknowledged at this point that he was a prophet, didn't even realize that he was the Son of God. So as all these attacks are directed his way, how is the blind man going to respond? With great simplicity and great brilliance. Verse 25. He answered, whether he, and of course we're talking about Jesus there, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. What had more weight in his mind? Some difficulties regarding how to apply rabbinic law to the Sabbath? Or the fact that he had been born blind and made to see? You see the point? He did not disbelieve because of some theories that he could not grasp. He believed because of what he knew. And that's the way it should be with us today. There are some things we just know for a fact. We know because we have his words that no man ever spoke as Jesus spoke, John 7:46. His words has served as the basis of our Western civilization for 2,000 years. We know that over 500 people saw Jesus alive after he was dead. Most of them were willing to go through unspeakable torture to back up their testimony. We know that. We know that the eyewitness testimony of the apostles in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it rings true. Read the book of John. Read the description of the breaking of his leg. Tell me if that's not the description of an eyewitness that's telling the truth. We know that Jesus and the apostles believed in the Old Testament. We know that we can accept Jesus and his acceptance of the inspiration of the Old Testament. We know all of that. Now, I may not be able to explain every little thing in the law of Moses. But what do? I believe on the basis of what I do understand. Don't allow a few difficult texts to get in my way. So, that's our first point that we need to keep in mind, that we believe on the basis of what we understand. Now, here's a second important point. The horrible consequences of rejecting the moral standard that has served us for thousands of years. It seems that some people think they can just try to find, pick apart the Bible, and incidentally this has been going on for 2,000 years, reject it, and travel on their merry way as if there were going to be no consequences of that action. That's naive. It's as naive as it can be. If we cannot accept the Bible, and I'll add, as it should be rightly and correctly applied, it's not always applied that way, but if we can't accept the Bible as our moral standard, what is our standard of right and wrong? How do you say this is right and this is wrong? You're going to go to the world religions? Well, you have Islam. How's that working? You have Buddhism and Hinduism, and they don't even claim to be moral standards. Man has become his own standard when he rejects God. His feelings and the results when that happens are always disastrous. I find myself just tossing out these numbers, but we need to keep them in our mind. Societies that have rebelled against God. Well, you've got Nazi Germany. What's the number? 15 million around killed. You have Russia. Stalin, ex-theology student. What are the numbers? Maybe 30 million killed. You have China, Mao Zedong. How many people killed? Maybe 50 million. That's what happens. Now somebody says, it doesn't look like it's going to be that bad with us. Well, I think we pointed out yesterday, maybe not so bad in the first generation that rejects the Bible, rejects God. When you get to the second and third generations, that's when you start getting all kinds of perversions and moral relativism till you've got problems. Man just doesn't function well without God's standard. The further you will get away from God's standard, the worst it's going to be, both culturally and individually. And people today are concerned about serving Coca-Colas that are over 32 ounces in New York City. And people are concerned about the economic problems. What's going to happen with the fiscal cliff? What about the pollution in our air and our waters? I'm not saying that those things should not be any concern at all. But those problems are nothing. Zero in comparison to the problems caused by the spiritual emptiness that comes from rejecting God. And we're seeing it more and more in the broken homes and in the kids who are being raised without parents and without any concept of right and wrong. It's ruining us. It will also ruin our lives as individuals. Now, the emptiness of life without God doesn't prove that there's a God in and of itself, but it should make us want to analyze the evidence and to accept His Word. And the bottom line is, there's just something in us to rebel against the concept that there's no moral standard. I think God put that rebellion in us. We need to listen to it. But maybe when we're thinking of the law of Moses in particular, the most important preliminary is this next one. And that is the purpose of the law of Moses. It was never intended to reflect God's ideals. And every time we read from the law, we've got to keep that in mind. And there's a verse, Matthew 19 and verse 8, which is probably a key. There's some others we're going to mention as well. But it's a key in understanding that fact. What's going on in Matthew 19? Well, you ought to know, probably. This is where Jesus has a conflict with the Jews about divorce. We'll read from the beginning in verse 3 to get the context. The Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female?" Notice where Jesus is going for his answer. He's going to the law of Moses. He's going to the very beginning. Verse 5, and said, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." That's the beginning, Genesis 2:24. And he goes on in verse 6, "So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." Well, that's what Jesus said about divorce. And he made his application from it. But we know that the Jews he was talking to were not content with that. They said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?" The answer in verse 8 is of great importance even for us today. Verse 8. Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wife. But from the beginning, it was not so." Why did God tolerate and regulate something that was not his ideal? Because of their hardness of heart. We're talking primitive culture. A culture that had gone a long way away from God's original. God's purpose is to take them now, and with this law of Moses as a kind of a stopgap measure, take the Jews, prepare them to return back towards his ideal regarding marriage, and especially to be willing to accept Jesus Christ. This is a point that both the Jews and the new atheists just don't understand. The law of Moses, written to a hard-hearted people, not meant to reflect God's ideal. Now, there's some other passages that point this out as well. Look at Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13. This is a text that's given to us just after the writer quotes Jeremiah 31, talking about the new covenant that God was going to make with his people. It's kind of a summary, an application taken from the previous verses. The writer says, in speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. You get the point? Law of Moses reflects God's ideal? No. Law of Moses written to hard-hearted, primitive people designed. We used to talk in automobiles, pre-planned obsolescence. Law of Moses had its pre-planned obsolescence. God wanted something better for his people, and we get it in Jesus Christ. I'm going to give you an illustration and then a text to back it up. Now, this illustration has a germ of truth and a germ of Gardner in it, but I think it'll help us understand. I've read as a young man about missionaries, in quotation marks, that went to a very primitive place, New Guinea, just to the north of Australia. The tribes were so primitive and backwards that they just constantly were killing each other. If there is a problem, the way to settle the problem, almost any type of problem, was just to kill the fellow you had a problem with. So that is the world to which these Westerners came. Well, what would you do if you went there? And you see all these people killing each other whenever there's a problem. You might say, could we have a court system based upon English common law with lawyers and a prosecutor and a jury and a judge? Would those people be ready for that type of problem resolution? I think they might even try to think of something like this. No, no, stop. Stop killing each other. Tell you what, if you in this village have a problem with you in this village, get your best wrestler. Let's get him out, and whoever wins the wrestling match wins. And maybe that would be a good substitute for just killing everybody. Well, is that, would that be an ideal judicial system? You gotta get Hulk Hogan or someone, I can tell how old I am now, referring to wrestlers by name. Get some big wrestler and say, we're gonna straighten this out right here on the wrestling match. That would not be ideal. But it would be a lot better than killing everybody in the opposite village. I think something like that's what's going on with the law of Moses. Yes, it's from God. But who's it for? People who just weren't in the position to accept God's ideal. And that's what Galatians 3 says, isn't it? Galatians 3, talking about the law. You remember the word, the old King James Version word is the word that comes to my mind. The law was a tutor. T-U-T-O-R. Not a horn tutor. A tutor, someone who teaches to bring us to Christ. I'm not sure if this is the full idea in the text, but a tutor is someone who does remedial work to help children come up to speed if they're behind on, and we used to say math, that's what they're usually behind on. What they teach is remedial, it's not grade level. What's the law of Moses? Remedial, not grade level. It was to take the Jews incrementally, step by step, towards civilization and an understanding that would help them, at least those who are spiritually minded, accept Jesus Christ and his ideal. So those are some very important things to keep in mind when analyzing these tough lessons. I hope I'm not getting over everybody's head. I don't think I am. I've got good attention. This is a heavy topic. Heavy duty. And I think you're with me. Well, it may be getting a little heavier now. Let's go to the second part of the lesson. And we'll start taking these accusations that are made against the Old Testament one by one. Is the Bible sexist? Does the Bible condone slavery? What about all the warfare? Now, I'm not going to answer every doubt that you may have about every text. But I think we can show that there are some explanations, maybe give some that you didn't know about. Some have pointed out that if we had a better understanding of the Hebrew language and the Hebrew culture, that some of these difficulties would be even more easily resolved. The Hebrew language is a toughie, and there's some words, I think you read along sometimes and you see the little note beside, it says the exact definition of this word, we don't know. There's so much we don't know, that would help us as well. Well, here's the first question. Is the Bible sexist? Another way to say it, is the Bible, and especially the Old Testament, against women? The answer is no. But I know you want some explanations, so we'll be giving them to you. First of all, before getting into some of the tough texts, notice how the Old Testament elevates women. Women were badly treated 2,000 years before Christ. They were often treated as property among primitive tribes. Notice what the Old Testament is doing for them. Genesis 1:21, God made what? Male and female equality. Some other verses. Honor your father only. Honor your father and your mother. Give them equal honor. And there's a whole list of verses there. You know they're all through the Old Testament about honoring. Here's an interesting little verse. I don't often quote the Song of Solomon in my preaching, but the explanation of who owns who. Did God want men to own women? I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. No male ownership over women here. Who are some influential women in the Old Testament? Who are some heroes in the Old Testament? Start making a list. You know, you've got Eve. You've got Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Hannah, Deborah. He's an interesting case. The Queen of Sheba, Huldah, etc., etc., etc. When you think of the prominence given to these women, I don't think we're talking about something that indicates that God is undervaluing women. Well, with that in mind, let's look at some of the texts that supposedly devalue women. Now, this is a tough one. This is one of the toughest ones for me. Deuteronomy 5, 11 through 31. We're not going to read the whole thing. This is the test of the waters, the bitter waters. And if you read in the Old Testament, you probably remember this and scratched your head a few times about it. The trial of jealousy to determine adultery. And what was done was water was taken and mixed with a little dust from the altar, and the woman who was accused by her husband, and as we're going to point out, perhaps the man who was accused by her wife, would drink the water. There was no adultery. There would be no illness. If there were adultery, there would be illness. When I first read this or think about it, well, it's kind of tough. But when you think about it a little more, you realize that there may be some explanation. What are the two questions that come to our mind? Well, what made this test of drinking the bitter waters effective? And was it really sexist? Did it demean women? Well, let's look at the first one. What made the test effective? You know what I see this as being like? It's something to protect the innocent woman. It's something like Solomon's test. You remember Solomon's test when two women brought a baby to him, said each one claiming that baby? Solomon said, well, let's just take a sword and let's kill that baby. Now, was Solomon really going to do that? It was kind of a psychological test. The woman who truly was the mother of the baby would not allow it. And therefore, it was revealed which one was the true mother. I think that's the kind of thing that we have going on here. It's using a little bit of psychology. In the first place, I don't think a little dust in the water is going to make somebody sick. However, dealing with our primitive cultures here, if a woman or a man, as I'm going to point out a little later, is guilty, is she going to want to take that test? She's going to want to avoid it. But if she's innocent, or if he's innocent, that's going to be something that's going to help this jealous husband get off my back. Give me that water. And I think by the very reaction to this type of test, you're going to have a good idea of who is guilty and who is innocent. Does it unfairly target women? No, it's supposed to protect them and help them. Some have suggested maybe some divine intervention here. I'm not sure that that's guaranteed in the text. So, though there's some things we may not understand when we think of it a little longer, these are some things that might explain it. Well, if you look at the context, start reading before, verse 2, verse 6, later on, We're dealing with principles that apply equally to males and females. I don't think, and I'm not sure how much this test was actually practiced in the Old Testament, but I think that if a woman wanted to use it against her philandering husband, I don't think anybody would have opposed it. In Matthew, just an illustration of that point quickly. Matthew 19 verse 9 prohibits a man from divorcing his wife. But how do we apply that text? We apply it legitimately to a wife who's wanting to divorce her husband. And Mark chapter 10 verse 12 backs us up in that fact. But the principle that would apply to one would apply to the other. In Matthew 19 as well as here. So we're dealing with both men and women in the context. So that's something for you to think about if you ever hear this passage used to try to discredit the Bible. Well, what about having many wives? Does the Old Testament back up polygamy or bigamy? Polygamy is having a bunch of wives. Bigamy is two wives. Of course, a lot of the old people in the Old Testament did have multiple wives. Was that God's ideal? Jesus said it wasn't in Matthew chapter 19. What's God's doing? He's taking something that was already deeply ingrained in a primitive culture, regulating it, even though it's not his ideal, preparing people to accept his ideal, which is man, singular, leaves his father and mother, cleaves to his wife, singular. That's the ideal from the beginning. Well, what about this text, Deuteronomy 21:15-17? Look at it closely. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him children, and if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then on the day when he assigns his possessions as an inheritance to his son, he may not treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. And that's not the one I want to have. Okay, there we go. What's the purpose of this text? To promote polygamy? You know it's not. This is one of those if, then, just like the text on divorce and remarriage. If he divorces, then you'd better do this. That's the case here. If a man has two wives, not that he's wanting that. If he has two wives, I'm going to protect, God says, this one is love left. The whole text here is designed to regulate something that wasn't God's ideal to protect the one who would be the victim of what was God's ideal. Polygamy is not promoted. It's tolerated and regulated until these primitive people to come to understand God's will better. Someone has made this point as well. This is a point in passing. That as you read through the Old Testament, you see a progression as it seems that God's people began, they had their downtime, believe me, with the idolatry, but especially in the post-exilic community, came closer and closer to God. You don't read a lot of polygamy towards the end of the Old Testament. And even by the time you get to the time of Jesus, polygamy was out. What had happened? They had been civilized by this law of Moses. Well, let's go to another question. I don't want to get too deep in this. What about the violence? When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God gives them into your hand, and you take them captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman, and you desire to take her to be your wife, and you bring her home to your house, she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall take off all the clothes in which she was captured, and shall remain in your house and lament her father and her mother a full month. After that you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife, but if you no longer delight in her, you shall let her go where she wants, but you should not sell her for money, no slaver here, nor you shall treat her as a slave since you have humiliated her. Well, that's a bit of a head scratcher as well. Is God saying for the children of Israel to take women as war booty? No, it's designed to protect the women. If you stop and think about it, this is designed to protect the woman in a primitive culture. What happens and this is a pretty strong statement, but we know what happens to most women in unbridled warfare. They're violated. This text is designed to put a stop to that. They could not be raped. If you see someone that attracts you, you've got to marry her, and you can't just marry her. You've got to wait a month before you do it. That might make them think a little more. And if you're going to let her go, you treat her not as a slave. You treat her as a wife. You protect her. No, we're not talking with God's ideal here. We're designed with regulations for a hard-hearted, primitive people so that later they could operate at a higher level. Well, quickly, I'm thinking this is getting a little heavy duty. You know, you can see the reaction of the people watching. I got a little blurry eyes, but both of you are hanging in there with me. Does the Old Testament promote slavery? No. Notice these texts. If these texts were followed, there would be no slavery. Exodus 21:16. Whoever steals a man and sells him, or anyone found in possession of him, shall be put to death. If they had applied that in the pre-Civil War South, there would have been no slavery. Deuteronomy 23:15-16. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place of those that, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, whatever suits him. You shall not wrong him. What about runaway slaves? They are not to be returned. There were great rights and privilege given to Jewish slaves. Now, here's one thing we need to point out. A big, important asterisk right here. When we think of slaves, often we think of those who are abused and beaten. The idea among Jews was probably more identified with what we would call indentured servants, those who work for a period of years under a contract for another. Maybe they're dealing with poverty or debt. You remember what Jacob did to marry his wife? Most of us remember that story. He had to work 7 years for her. And then we got to see he had to work 7 more years. He was a little bit of what we're talking about here. Someone working to pay off a debt or to pay for something. In Jacob's case, a wife. This was a common setup in the ancient Near East. Not ideal, but that's the way it was. And all regulations in the Old Testament regarding slavery or servitude are designed to protect those who were under that. Now, Jewish slaves had tons and tons of rights, and they would even have to be released ever so often. Even foreign slaves had plenty of rights and privileges, not quite as many as Jewish slaves. For example, a number of texts require kind treatment to foreigners. These are often quoted today in regards to the immigration problem, but there are a bunch of them like that. Naomi and Ruth were acquired by Boaz. They were in foreign indentured service. Were they beaten and mistreated? No, he married her. So we're not talking the ancient antebellum South. And maybe even there it wasn't as bad as universally evil as far as mistreatment. The system is bad, but the mistreatment was always daily beating. A descendant of Caleb, Shisha. Never thought you would hear about Shisha, but you're hearing of him right now. He gave his daughter to a foreign servant, Jartha. You know, sometimes you need to read those first chapters of Chronicles. You get a few little tidbits out of there. Not the easiest reading, but you can find things there. But what's the point? That there are regulations designed to protect slaves in the Old Testament. No promotion of it. Regulation of something that wasn't God's ideal. I want to mention quickly the New Testament here. Although we're dealing primarily today with the Old Testament. The Romans had a full-blown slavery system. It was worse than what anything like the Jews had. We're not talking indentured servants. We're talking Roman slavery. Some were treated very harshly. You know, some of them may have been treated well. The New Testament gives principles which eventually overturn slavery. Look at a few of them. Jesus came to free the captives. We're talking primarily spiritually here. But there may have been a secondary way in which we're applying to physical slaves. Several texts talk about the fact that slaves, as far as God are concerned, are equal with the free. To save time, we won't read those texts. You probably know them. What are some other points we can get? In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 10, Paul, the NIV is very interesting. He condemns slave trading or kidnapping. So we have condemnation of that. In Revelation chapter 18, verse 13, we see Babylon condemned, probably Rome, for trading in the bodies and souls of men. Do you think the New Testament promotes slavery? Get it out and look it over a little bit better. It does not promote slavery. It doesn't, however, advocate social revolution as a way of dealing with slavery. Rather, we see that incremental approach, promoting love, promoting dignity, promoting equality, and that eventually overturns slavery. Even in our own country, we see our slavery eroded not by social revolution, but incrementally. If you're a history buff, and I think there may be a few of us left in this world, you may remember the story of John Brown. He was someone who tried with slow social revolution to overturn slavery. Didn't get very far. Abraham Lincoln tried the more incremental approach. And although we didn't take the Civil War and some other things, I don't want to rehash old history, but slavery was eventually overcome. Who was more successful, Abraham Lincoln or John Brown? Of course, you see the point. But don't let anybody tell you that the Bible, either the Old Testament or the New Testament, promotes slavery. There are regulations and principles given, but no promotion. Well, finally, what about violence in the Old Testament? Is there ethnic cleansing in the Bible? That's what Richard Dawkins said. A couple of things to keep in mind. A lot of the Old Testament texts which deal with violence is violence that was not accepted by God. You remember why David was not allowed to build the temple? Because he was a man of too much bloodshed. And yet, there are cases where God commanded violence. And that's what we're going to talk about as we close up the lesson here. But, again, some points to keep in mind. The conquest of the land of Canaan was delayed from the time of Abraham. God did not think that they were bad enough during Abraham's day to remove them. It would not have been justifiable. He said, this is not going to happen. Your descendants will not take the land until the iniquity of the Amorite was full. Interesting to note that Sodom and Gomorrah were there then. They're about as bad as you can get. God still wanted that level to reach a higher plane before he would take that land away from them. How wicked were they? There were perversions. Their worship involved temple sex, bestiality, homosexuality, even child sacrifice, extreme violence. We have the god Anath reveled in gory violence. Sometimes societies reach a level of depravity that they need to be destroyed. And we're not talking ethnic cleansing. Some Canaanites were spared. We have Rahab. We have the Gibeonites. They accepted God's power and were spared. So it's not just a matter of ethnicity. It's a matter of deprivation on one hand and acceptance of the other. Here's what Paul Copan says about the conquest. It was unique to Israel at a particular point in time and was not to be repeated in later history by Israel or by other nations. Without God's explicit command, and thus his morally sufficient reason, attacking the Canaanites would not have been justified. Well, let's briefly look at, and I promise you I will not be preaching this long the rest of the week. I'm usually a 30-minute to 35-minute guy, but this is, you can see there's a lot of material here. So please come back later in the week. Some tough text, and I think I can wind this up in 5 or 6 minutes. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3. Here is where God told Saul to destroy the Amalekites. And what grabs our attention from this passage? And you can tell I'm skimming through this. I'm just giving you some thoughts. The Israelites were told to destroy even the animals, the women, and children are mentioned here. This is the only text in the Old Testament where children are mentioned. Who were the Amalekites? A morally depraved people who had attacked Israel again and again, especially when they were most vulnerable. There are several explanations given, and I'm not sure of all of them. One man pointed out that really we're talking about a military operation against a military garrison, and that we're talking an idiomatic expression here, destroy beasts, men, women, and children. That simply means clean them out in that military base. I'm not 100% sure of that, but that's something for you to consider. I think sometimes it's better to say, this is just one of those things I may not understand completely. Remember the first point we made. I don't understand this. I do understand that. I think maybe you can make this point, although I would not hang my hat completely on it, that sometimes societies reach a point of degradation. And can you imagine killing innocent little babies and sacrifice to God, where the best thing is just to wipe it out and start again? You can make that argument. If children were killed, where do they go? They went to heaven. Did not have to participate in the moral corruption of their society. You can make the same point when you talk about other Canaanite cities that were destroyed in the conquest. Jericho, Ai, and other Canaanite cities. In the case of Ai, and probably Jericho as well, we're not talking so much destruction. We're talking military destruction here. But I'm sure that there were some others involved in this matter. Numbers chapter 31, 17 and 18. Here we talk about the destruction of the Midianites. The Midianites, with their prophet Balaam, remember that story from our childhood, tried at first to wipe out the children of Israel with curses. That didn't work. Then they tried to destroy the children of Israel with pagan sex rituals. And they were much more successful for that. So we have that as the context of the command here in Numbers 31 to destroy all of them. All males who would be killed were potential military threats to God's people. All non-virgin women could be moral threats. What had they just done? Tried to seduce the children of Israel. And in this case, the virgins were spared. They could more easily be integrated into Israelite society. And they were. According to some of the principles that we talked about earlier in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 10 through 14. Well, we've just flown through a few. My point is, there are explanations often to some of these difficult passages. And even if we don't have them all understandable, we can hang our hat on what we know. And all of these texts must be interpreted in the fact, in the light of the fact that God was dealing with a very primitive and violent culture. He's moving them incrementally towards Him. He's trying to get them to separate from even worse cultures. And that explains so much of what's going on. One thing we can know, the world is evil. And there's a place for wrath against that evil. Somebody says you're giving the Bible the benefit of the doubt. Absolutely. If there's any book that has blessed our Western world and our civilization, it is the Bible. It's the fountain of love, peace, and purpose in the world. And how tragic it is when some people would take a few difficult verses, and we touched on a few of them today, and allow it to cause them to reject such blessings and to slide back in those shallow, empty lifestyles and lose their moral compass. Don't let that happen to you. Keep the moral basis. Keep with which you can teach your children the differences between right and wrong. If we don't, we're going back to Romans chapter 1. That ugly description of a society with God. Without God, a society without Him. So let's focus on those things that give us hope and faith. The only one that gives us hope is Jesus Christ. Do you have Jesus Christ? There's some things you can know about Him. Even if you don't understand the test of the bitter waters, you can know Jesus. You want the newness of life that he gives? You need to be baptized in him, buried with him in baptism, rise to walk up in newness of life. Let us know if we can help you. Let's stand now and sing the invitation song. You're right.